You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Erin Aubrey Kaplan. If you're struggling to pay rent because of the pandemic, listen up. The city of Los Angeles just announced a new effort to pay 100% of back rent for low-income households who have fallen behind because of COVID-19. That's great news for people like Zara Bloom.
I am a native Angeleno. I currently have been living in this apartment for 6 years, almost to the day, actually.
Zara lives in a one-bedroom bungalow in Silver Lake. It's cheap for the neighborhood, about $930 a month. But as she points out, it's cheap for a reason.
The paint is definitely peeling. These lights don't work. The stairs are uneven.
Still, for Zara, it was fine before the pandemic. Then she lost her job, fell behind on rent, and now she's afraid of getting evicted. The new rent relief program approved by the city council and the mayor yesterday could be a real lifeline for her. KCRW reporter Anna Scott is here to explain. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Erin.
So what's the city going to do for tenants like Zara?
They're planning to pay all of the back rent accumulated during the pandemic for low-income households like Zara's that lost income because of COVID-19. So if you're a renter in this position, you'll have to show that you earn under a certain amount of money per year to qualify, and that you lost a job because of the pandemic or missed work because you got sick or something like that. But if you qualify, the city is saying they'll cover you to keep you housed.
Didn't they already make this promise? And for that matter, didn't the state also promise the same thing?
Yes, this will be the third round of rent relief that's been offered in the city of LA since the pandemic started. The first was somewhat small. It offered just up to a couple $1,000s per household. Then in the spring, there was a bigger effort that's similar to this one that's starting now. But the city was so slammed with applications, all of that money was spoken for in less than a month. With this new effort, they're promising to cover not only everyone who qualified in the last round but got shut out of the application period, but tens of thousands of additional households. The goal is to cover everybody who meets the criteria.
Well, how are they going to do that? Where is all the money coming from?
All of the money comes down from the federal government. So California got a huge pot of money for rent relief, and some big cities like LA received their own chunk the last time around to administer rent relief themselves. One problem, though, has been that LA, and they're not alone in this, by the way, it's been slow to hand out the money. Zara Bloom, for example, she was on the ball enough to apply for rent relief back in April, the last time applications opened. She'd been laid off from her job at a legal services company after a lot of courtrooms closed. She filed for unemployment, but she says that there were glitches in the system and that led to skipped checks. And it was hard to get anybody on the phone to fix that. So she found herself in the position of having to pick which bills to pay.
When you are like poor most of your life, I hate saying that word. So when you're in a lower income bracket, you know, most of your adult life, and some of my childhood, like, you do prioritize how you spend your bills. Like, you know, you're not going to pay your student loan bill when you only made $1,000 that month, right? But rent, so it was always you pay your rent first, foremost, any overeating, you pay your rent. Rent was always number one, always.
But after she applied for relief from the city, she expected to receive it. She met the criteria, so she stopped paying the rent for the first time. Now she says her application is still pending. She owes more than $7,000 in back rent. And although her landlord can't evict her for that because of state and local eviction moratoriums, they are pressuring her to leave by threatening eviction over other things like unapproved outdoor furniture, for example. And a lot of renters are in a similar limbo, according to tenant advocacy organizations that I interviewed for this story. And a typical wait time until now in the city between applying for rent relief and getting the money, if you made it into that last application pool, is about 90 days. So Zara's been really frustrated by what's felt like a whole year of dealing with systems that sound good on paper, unemployment, rental assistance, but in her experience have been very hard to get help from when she needs it.
Like, I don't know how much I can, like, convey, like, what's going on, because I think at the surface, when people look at stuff like that, like this, they kind of think you can figure it out somehow, but they don't understand, like, all the tiny things that lead to somebody being unhoused. Like, right now, this is exactly what's happening to me.
But the city's decision Wednesday to create this new program could help a lot.
Okay, so how will it be different from the slow system they've had so far?
This time, instead of LA taking its own chunk of federal dollars to distribute to renters, They're forming a new partnership with the state of California, and the state government, for the most part, is going to take over administering the rent relief. And the mechanics of this are complicated, but the upshot is that doing this is going to allow Los Angeles to tap into a much bigger pot of money and so help more people. And it should speed things up. State officials say that they're close to achieving a 30-day timeline between receiving applications and paying people money. And if landlords don't want to participate for any reason, tenants will be able to receive payments themselves directly and then use that money to pay the rent.
It's hard to imagine landlords wouldn't want this money. This is about making them whole too, right?
Yes, absolutely. And one landlord that I spoke to, Shia Lowenstein, owns about a half dozen buildings in the city of LA. And he says most of his tenants have kept up with the rent, but enough have fallen behind to cost him tens of thousands of dollars in rental income. And he's been really frustrated because he says the confusion around the rental relief programs so far and a lack of clear information about exactly who's eligible has been one of the big issues he's run into.
I had tenants for a long time, you know, several tenants who just for several months didn't pay their rent. And I said, are you not back? You know, are you back to work? When let's figure something out. Let's come up with a payment plan. And they said, oh, I'm not going to pay my rent because, you know, the state, this California, said they're going to cover the rent. They frankly did not understand any of this. So there was a lot of information that was being put out there that was just confusing by government agencies.
He's also been frustrated that there hasn't been any relief specifically for landlords whose rental income has decreased because of the pandemic. Like, for example, there hasn't been any break on expenses that the city and county directly control, like property taxes or trash fees.
That's absolutely a lot of the frustration. I've spoken to a lot of landlords and we're all feeling the same thing where, you know, the impression, the message that we're getting is, you know, we want you to foot all these bills, but don't let it hit our pocketbooks.
Well, the new rent relief won't affect those costs, right? But if it works as planned, it could assist a lot of tenants and their landlords in making up on all that missed rent. Where can people find out more or apply for this fund?
People can start applying on Wednesday, September 1st at 7 a.m. at housingiskey.com. And if you're a renter who already applied to the city's program, but either missed the cutoff after they shut it down or still has an application pending, according to city officials, you will get instructions on what to do next.
Okay, that's housingiskey.com. Anna Scott covers housing and homelessness for KCRW. Thanks, Anna.
Thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA. I'm Erin Aubrey Kaplan, in for Steve Chiatakis. Earlier this month, UCLA and the entire city of Los Angeles lost a colleague, mentor, friend, and advocate for educational justice. In his books and in the classroom, Mike Rose was known for chronicling the transformative power of learning, something he believed everyone was capable of, regardless of their race, status, or background. Rose was the author of many books, including Lives on the Boundary and Possible Lives, seminal works that really emphasized the human but often forgotten element at the core of this great big thing we call education. He died on August 15th at age 77 after falling ill. So here to remember Mike are two people who knew him very well. Tina Christie is the Wasserman Dean of the UCLA School of Education and Information Studies, where Rose taught and was a research professor. And Naila Suad Nasir is a former student of Rose's, and she now heads up the Spencer Foundation, which creates grants to support educational research. I want to thank you both for coming on, and I'm so sorry we're talking under these circumstances. I was also a friend of Mike's, not for as long as you guys were, but a friend and a great fan of his writing. Tina, I'll start with you. How long did you work alongside Mike, and how would you describe him?
Thank you, Erin. And thank you for inviting us to talk about our dear friend, colleague, mentor, and I will say, as you probably well know, dedicated NPR listener. Mike can only be described as a great American educator. I've known Mike since 1997 when I started my doctoral training at UCLA and maintained a close friendship with him over the years. To my mind, Mike was one of the most extraordinary storytellers that education has ever been introduced to. While he was such a gifted storyteller, he was also a very rigorous academic. He spent his careers in classrooms from kindergarten classes, and you may know he was, in fact, a kindergarten teacher. He was in GED classes, medical school classes, and what he did was observe teaching and learning to understand, dissect, as you said, the transformational opportunities and promises of that common classroom.
Can you talk a little bit about his younger years, his growing up in South Central LA in the 1950s, and how that experience shaped the work he did and the outlook he had?
Mike grew up in South Central LA. His family moved from the coal mines in Pennsylvania. His father was ill. He had an immune compromised disorder. And they thought that the weather here in Southern California would be better for his health. And Mike's father was really unable to work. His mother was spent her life working in restaurants as a server. And Mike spent much of his childhood sitting in restaurants with his mother. So to Mike, the restaurant wasn't just a place you went to grab a meal. It was a home. It was a place where he kept himself occupied, where he played, where he got to know people from the neighborhood. And a lot of those people were working class people. And that became the core of who he was interested in throughout his career.
Right, right. He really came from working class roots. Describe how he made his way to higher education. It wasn't expected.
I don't think he expected it for himself, and I don't think that that as structural inequities are in our society and existed then and have persisted, obviously, the expectation wasn't that he would actually pursue an education, and it was the importance of that special teacher, that teacher who connected to him on a human level, that inspired him to pursue an education. And this is what he writes about in his most recent book that is yet to be published, titled When the Light Goes On. He talks about education fundamentally as a human experience. And in that human connection, the light goes on. And that's how Mike ended up going to school. It wasn't a straight path. There were curves and twists to his trajectory, but eventually earning his PhD from UCLA.
Right. It is remarkable. I'll just add, he has written that he was actually on a vocational education track in high school because he was mixed up with another student also named Mike Rose. And so a teacher took notice and he switched direction, but it was sort of a quirk of fate. Naila, you have said in an interview that you would not have a PhD today were it not for Mike. Why is that? And what made him such a tremendous and influential teacher?
Well, I think it's some of what Tina has touched on in relation to his work, that human element, that deep respect for teachers and the work of teaching and the thinking of working class folks. He approached his mentoring in the same way. So as a doctoral student, I was from a working class background. I landed at UCLA with a lot of ambition, but not a lot of knowledge of what it meant to be getting a PhD or how to make sense of this seemingly very sophisticated discourse that others were using that I didn't quite understand. And Mike was the person that made the whole thing human. He made it an experience of respect. And there was something about the way that he talked to you, the way that he listened to your ideas about your work, the way that he described research in the field, and then him embodying being a fully whole human, caring person that made it feel like, okay, this is possible. It's possible to be both a whole human and a scholar. It's possible to care deeply about ideas and research and also to care deeply about people and have a social life outside of the academy. So it was what he it was what he modeled and what he allowed you to be that that made the whole thing seem much less alienating and more like a possible home space.
Wow, yeah, very inspirational. And I just want to add, you know, he really was a believer in the value and the complexity of work. He wrote all of his books by hand with a pencil on a legal pad, which I just, as a writer myself, makes me feel absolutely lazy. But just one of many incredible things about him. Yeah. So this is a question for both of you on the subject of books. If there's one book of Mike's you think someone out there listening to this program who may not be familiar with him should read, what would it be? And let's start with you, Nayila.
I love that story about the yellow pad, and it so underscores the points he was making in The Mind at Work about the connection between the body and the mind and thinking and identity and how all those things are woven together in moments of learning. I would say for me, it would be Possible Lives. And that's because he told me the story once of the writing of Possible Lives and said that he'd written Lives on the Boundary and it had, you know, done really well, obviously, and had sparked much conversation about what was wrong with public education. And he wanted to make sure that the world knew there was so much right about public education. So Possible Lives was a book where he went all around the country finding places where amazing teaching was happening and describing it in great rich detail. So I think that's an absolute must read around the possibility of learning and education.
Yeah, good point. Places where the light was going on. Tina, what about you? What book would you recommend?
I would have to agree with Nayila. The first book I read of Mike's was Lives on the Boundary, but Possible Lives really... And it's about the journey, right? The journey into the classroom, his journey across the U.S. into these classrooms. And what Mike really does in that book is he takes the common classroom and he shows you what's extraordinary about it. And that was what Mike did. He took the common person, their experience, the common classroom, the teacher's experience, and he showed you what was extraordinary about it and how it was transformative, how it can be transformative. And Possible Lives is the book that does that to me, to my mind, just as Nayila said.
Yeah, great recommendations both. I want to thank you both for coming on and for illuminating Mike Rose's life and his contributions. Tina Christie heads up UCLA School of Education and Information Studies, and Nayila Sawad Nasir is the president of the Spencer Foundation. And they were talking about their friend, my friend and mentor, UCLA professor and author Mike Rose, who died earlier this month. Thank you guys both so much.
Thank you so much, Aaron.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
He will be missed at the Galley, the restaurant on Main Street in Santa Monica, where he was a regular, knew everybody there, held court just about every week. The Galley was his second home, and it will be impossible to go there and not think of Mike Rose. Back now with Greater LA. I'm Erin Arby Kaplan, sitting in for Steve Chiatakis. After 20 years, an LA staple is making her exit. Nita Lelyveld has long been the City Beat columnist at the LA Times And over the years, she's dug into really interesting pockets and narratives that are often close up and personal, but that also have revealed a lot about L.A. and its character. So in the search for character, Nita has explored just so many aspects of humanity, often hidden, and they all come together to comprise this diverse and sometimes mystifying and always changing city. She created the hashtag #MyDayInLA to, quote, make a big city feel like a small town. The community that Nita created online will continue to thrive as she uproots and heads to Maine really soon. She recently made the tough decision to head back east. But before she does, she's joining us to reminisce about what she'll miss most about L.A. Hi, Nita.
Hi, how are you, Erin?
I'm doing well. Thanks for coming on. I know you are in the middle of, literally in the middle of leaving, so I appreciate you talking with us. So first off, we're very sorry to see you go, but I have to tell you, I have always been captivated by your columns, and I really loved how they delved into life here and all the big issues here, and I always saw them as passionate, but just not sentimental, and I'm a native Angeleno, so that's high praise. So just tell me first, how did you create your approach or your eye or, your whole way of looking at the city?
You know, I'm a person who just believes in observing everything closely. I soak up my surroundings, and that's what I've done with LA. I go out every day and explore it, and it's been important to me not to write stories off other people's stories, but to find my own stories. And you do that by being out on the street looking all the time and searching for what's interesting and what's changing and what's particular to this place.
Wow. Well, you know, going out and on the streets of LA is, you know, not a small undertaking. I mean, it's a big city, very spread out. Tell me about your process.
Sometimes I'd have an idea in mind, so I'd go out to follow an idea. Sometimes I would just explore a neighborhood on foot, looking for what struck me. I often tried to go to places that I didn't think were being written about much, in search of interesting stories. And then I would also do a certain amount of scouring the internet, trying to find people who were doing interesting things here.
Yeah, interesting, but kind of off the beaten path. And that's, you know, I remember a lot of the characters and the people in your columns. And how did you find the people? Did you just, in your explorations, you found them or did you hear about them? You know, sometimes finding those people can be like going after needles in haystacks in L.A. So just curious to know that.
All of the above. People would tell me about interesting people. I would discover them myself. One of the great things, you mentioned the Twitter community that I created, and that was very, very important for me in terms of building a community that felt connected to the newspaper, but also a community that felt connected to each other and to me. And I got many great story ideas from people who got involved in that community and who would send their My Day in LA photos of their lives in LA. They would think about me when they saw something interesting and let me know.
Wow. Well, what do you think you'll miss most about LA?
Just the surprises around every corner. It's funny, when I first came out here, I was the West Coast writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. I was just supposed to be here for a few years. And I fell in love with LA. And people back east would say to me, if you're the West Coast writer, why don't you live in San Francisco? It's so pretty. And San Francisco seemed to reveal itself so much more easily than LA. But what I loved about LA was that hidden behind facades that might seem bland, like our mini malls, for instance, were these incredible stories and journeys, and I just loved discovering them, digging in and looking for them.
Oh, it's well said. Yeah. Well, in your latest column, you say you're, quote, heading home to the East Coast, to Maine specifically. So talk a little bit about the idea of home. I mean, what you just described about L.A., like, really, you were finding the home here, you know, under the surface. Did LA really come to feel like home for you, or did you always feel like that East Coast transplant?
LA feels absolutely like home to me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to miss it so much. I love it so much. And I have lived here now so much longer than I've lived anywhere else in my life. I'm from the East Coast, but I've lived in LA many years longer than I've lived in any one place elsewhere.
Wow. So you're going to Maine to become city editor at the Portland Press Herald. I know that's, you know, you're excited about that. We wish you the best of luck. Nita Lelyveld is the LA Times City Beat columnist for the moment. Nita, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our show for today. Next week, Lucha Libre. You know, the Mexican wrestling with the guys in tights and capes and masks. And what's going to happen at the end of the month when the extra $300 a month of federal unemployment money comes to an end? Just some of our stories next week on Greater LA. As always, you can check out the show anytime at kcrw.com/GreaterLA and subscribe to the podcast there and wherever you get your podcasts. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Christine Comito, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordal all had a hand in our show today, and thank you for letting me have a hand. Greater LA, back on Monday. I'm Erin Aubrey Kaplan. Thanks for listening.